is a practice in the ancient world that's a little peculiar to us. Fascinating practice. You know, if two armies were lined up against each other, apparently somebody thought it didn't make a lot of sense to have all the mightiest people in your nation charge at each other and slaughter each other in the middle of a field, and therefore essentially render both nations incapacitated for a generation to come. That something else would make a lot more sense. Choose your best guy and send him out to fight for you. Now the danger of this is of course, if he loses, you can't say, that was just exhibition. That was just a trial. That was practice. No. Whoever you choose, that's it. You get one shot, right? And the best illustration of this in the Bible is what? Sure, here's the Philistines gathered seeking to do mortal harm to the Israelites, and they send out their grand champion, Shaquille O'Neal, right? This monster, this behemoth marches out to the center and he bellows slander against God and his people, and over on the other side, you know, on the Israelite side, nobody's stepping out, right? Nobody's willing to be the warrior. Nobody's found there to be the champion of God's people. And so everybody's quaking until God's spirit falls on one young man, and you know the rest of the story. Now, if your whole destiny's riding on that one representative, then you'd better have the right one, right? You know, there's something akin to this that we experience in our lives in powerful ways. And that is that every family has a head, don't they? Every family springs from some source. And the head of that family, be it a man or a woman or a couple or whoever, their behavior, their actions will either bless their family for generation and generation to come, or they will sow ill health and dysfunction for generations to come. Sometimes folks walk in my office and their life is messed up. And what they don't even realize is they are the product of what? Choices that may have been made by their great-grandparents, passed down through family lines of dysfunctional behavior that have now found a root in their lives. They don't even realize all the history that's gone into making them what they are. That's the way it is. Fathers, heads of families have this great power to bless for generations to come, and they have great power to just screw up their family for generations. I mean, if the father chooses to be zealous and passionate about God, to educate his children to know Christ, to love his wife and be faithful to her, let me tell you something, blessing will usually follow that family, not just to the children, but to the children's children and on down for a long time. I love this guy in our church who told me, Pastor, he said, my family are alcoholics. My father was an alcoholic. His father was an alcoholic. His father beat him. He beat me. I mean, we lived in a house of terror and unkindness. And, you know, he could just spill out the dysfunction of his family. And he said, I'm the first Christian in my whole family tree. I'm starting a whole new tree. I am now the source. I'm now the beginning of a whole new thing. That's going to go from generation to generation. This is so exciting. And God has called me, in a sense, to be the one who introduces grace and freedom and health and wholeness to this whole family that's going to come out and descend from me. I love the young girl who said she used to run 10Ks with her dad, and her dad was a better runner and stronger and more able, but she was pretty good. And when the race got in its latter stages and her legs were leaden and her lungs were burning and she'd want to quit, she'd find her dad somewhere in the crowd ahead of her. She'd fix her eyes on his back and she'd forget the pain and she'd forget the surroundings and she'd forget the runners and she'd said, I'm not going to lose sight of my dad. And so if he finished, she would finish. Now here's the quest for us. How do we get a father like that? How do we get a father? If we're latched to him, if we're attached to him, if we keep our eyes on him, we'll get to the finish line. Because you need to know something. Romans chapter 5 says that we're all in a family. And the head of our family has messed up our family for all time. The head of our family has chosen the way of rebellion and transgression and disobedience. And it has sowed garbage into all of us. It's the corruption. It's sin. It's depravity. It's in all of us. That's the head of our family. But there's another family. There is another father, and you can be in his family. He gets every one of his children to the finish line. He makes every one of his children healthy and whole and well, and he gets them all to heaven. It's a guarantee. You can be in that family. In the next few minutes, I'm going to tell you how. How does this second Adam bless his family, and how can you get in on it? Romans chapter 5, you have a sermon outline. We start with this. Is that the first father, the first family head, ruined his family by his rebellion. What does verse 12 say? Therefore, just as through one man, the head of our family, his name was Adam, through one man, what entered into the world? Sin entered the world through this one man's disobedience. Our representative, the head of our family, Adam, chose to rebel against God. And it renders all of us unrighteous. And not just legally unrighteous, but internally corrupt. Internally, we have hearts that their bent is to disobey God. Now, here's what you have to understand. Here's the way God set it up. Here was the deal. Adam's our representative. The Bible said Adam was made perfect without sin, and yet he had the ability to sin. And this is a probationary period. He's created with everything. God gives Adam everything. It is the plushest a life possible. He has personal fellowship with the living God. He has every reason to obey God. And God's rules and laws are not onerous or burdensome. There's every reason that he ought to love and recognize God as the very source of life and everything his soul would ever desire or crave. But God allows a probation. He allows a test. He allows someone to come to Adam and offer him a different life. Offer him autonomy. Offer him the chance to go his own and make it on his own without all this garden, with all this blessing, without all of God's tender, loving care. Adam can forge out and do it on his own. That's the test. Will Adam go for it? And the dreadful, terrible answer is he did. He did. He failed the test. And in failing the test, instead of securing eternal life and God's favor for his posterity forever, Adam secured for us what? Sin and death. Internal, personal corruption and rebellion against God. Sin entered the world through one man. Now, here's what you got to understand. Adam chose for you. In Adam, you sin. You rebelled against God. In Adam, you are guilty for that. You can say, well, that's unfair. I don't like that. I ought to pick my own representative. I didn't have any say in this. Let me tell you something. We have a hard time in the very individualized Western world where we value individual rights and individuality to grasp, but the rest of the world, frankly, has no trouble understanding this. People who are Asian value what more than anything else? The family. People in Africa value the tribe. That they understand this collective, that there's a representative that represents all of us. It's just the way it is. I think of the Bible of the people of Israel coming into the promised land. God promises them that they'll be militarily successful. They defeat the fortified city of Jericho with God's enabling, and then they go to take on this little puny non-factor opponent in the city of Ai, and suddenly the Israelites are routed, and everyone says, what happened? And what did happen? One of the Israelites stole the plunder from Jericho, which God had expressly forbidden them to do. And so he is taken out and he is stoned to death when God reveals who this is. But he's not only stoned, what else? His wife is killed. His children are killed. The whole group is killed. Because the choice of one represents the whole. That's just the way it is in God's economy. It ought to give us pause. That very point ought to give us pause to think about all manner of things in our Western world and how we regard family and how we regard church and such, understanding that this is God's economy, this is God's way, and yet what Paul is taking pains to point out in Romans chapter 5 is because of that, Adam is not merely a bad example which we chose to follow. Adam chose for us. In Adam we sinned. His choice was our choice. And if that's a novel thought to you, I want to tell you something a little bit convicting. You know, not very long ago in America, the way children learned how to read and write, the way they learned their alphabet, their little primer taught them this truth. Matter of fact, under the letter A, it said, A, in Adam's fall, we sinned all. Doctrine was taught to even the littlest children to understand that in Adam's transgression, we all fell under sin. And because of sin, what's the rest of the passage say? Death entered the world. And death spread to all men. This is the consequence of Adam's choice. You come to Genesis chapter 5. And you might look there. It's a fascinating passage. Because in the early pages of Genesis, all is bright. All is good. I mean, God makes the world. And God makes creation. And God fills what He's made with all the splendor of the created order. And at every point, God turns and He says, I saw what I made, and it was good. And finally, God says, when He makes man and He looks at the whole thing, He says, it was more than good. It was very good. I mean, glorious, beautiful, astounding. And then you get to Genesis chapter 5, and we read something entirely different. Just a couple pages into the Bible, after Adam's rebellion, it says that God made Seth. And Seth lived a long time, and then he died. I mean, if you're reading along, that ought to shock you. Everything was good. Everything was harmonious. Everything was sweet. God made Seth, and he died. God made Enosh, and he died. God made Kenan, and he died. God made Mahalalel, and he died. God made Jared, and he died. God made Enoch, and he didn't die. God made Methuselah, and he died. God made Lamech, and he died. He died. He died. He died. He died. And that's the curse that every one of us lives under, isn't it? Because our family head made that choice for us. And the wages of sin is what? It's death. God said, if you choose to disobey me, you shall surely what? You'll die. And do you know what's sad? Well, people die. They've always died. Dying's just the way it is. And people get used to it. There's a sense in which people just, the obituaries are in the paper every day, and that's the way life goes. You live and you die. But it wasn't meant to be that way. Sometimes it's only when a child dies we wake up, isn't it? When a child dies and you stand there and say, there's something wrong with this. Let me tell you something. When you stand at the grave of someone who's 98 and has had Alzheimer's for 30 years, you ought to stand there and say what? There's something wrong with this. I don't care what day, what age, what time, we weren't made for this. We were made to be eternal creatures. If our first representative had made the right choice and obeyed God, then eternal life would be ours for everyone. But he died, and he died, and he died, and I've stood in cemeteries with you, and we've looked in those graves, and we've said, death is our bitter enemy. There's a bumper sticker out, and I won't quote it for the parents' sake in here who don't like when I say those words. But the bumper sticker says, life stinks, and then you die. And do you know what? If the head of your family tree is Adam, that bumper sticker might be dark and it might be cynical, but it's absolutely true. That's all there is. It's even worse than that bumper sticker because that's not all there is. Life stinks and then you die and it gets worse. But there's another family. That's all of our family. And every one of us has stood at those graves. Every one of us has tasted death. I sat in my men's group last Friday morning. We talked about heaven and we asked the question, who would you like to see? Do you have anybody there? Do you have anybody close to you there? Who are you looking forward to linking up with there? And one of the men who's just, you know, placid. He never shows emotion. His eyes filled with tears. And he told us about it. His three-year-old little brother. When he was 4 and a half, his 3-year-old little brother died of leukemia. And as a 4 and a half-year-old, he said, I still remember that little, my little brother. And I hope he's in heaven. Death intrudes. Death is the result of rebellion against God, and every one of us have to taste that bitter pill. Adam's family. There's another family. And that's the second point in your sermon outline. There's a second head. Adam's not the only head of a family. There's another one. That's Paul's point in Romans chapter 5. Here the passage gets a little more complicated in verse 15 and 16 and 17, because Paul wants to tell us how Adam and Jesus are similar. But if you've ever read the writing of the Apostle Paul, you know what he does all the time? He's saying something, all of a sudden he stops and he goes off and he says something else. There's like a parenthesis. He just goes off on a tangent, and then way at the end he comes around and says what he was saying again. And it's like he wants to tell us Jesus and Adam are similar. That's his whole point. But before he can say that, he's got to tell us how Jesus and Adam are different. It's like he's embarrassed to say that anybody's like Jesus. And just to justify what he's about to say, he stops for just a minute and says, well, these two heads of the family, they really are different. They're different as to their, and here's the three blanks, as to their nature, the nature of their work, the effect of their work, and the power of their work. They really are different. If you look at verse 15, it couldn't be more clearer when he says, the free gift of Jesus is not like the work of Adam. Okay? They're different. They're different as to their nature. Look at verse 16. He says it again. The gift is not like that which came through Adam. Okay? But he wants to point out, Jesus' work is different than Adam's work. I want you to see the difference. Okay? And the first point is they differ as to their nature. Adam's choice was a choice of self-assertion, self-direction, self-love, self-will. God says, do this and you'll live. Adam decides to do what? I won't submit to you, God. I'm going my way, and then I'll really live. Has anybody made that choice since? Isn't that the heart? Isn't that the heart of man? There was a movie came out this year that mystified me. It was called American Beauty. It won all the Academy Awards. It was a foul movie. When you go and there's this character, and he decides that his life is dull, and it's a sort of a midlife thing. And so he quits his job. He just tells his boss exactly what he thinks about him. He takes a job at a hamburger joint. He rediscovers the pleasures of marijuana. He really abuses his wife and ignores her, and finds himself lusting after his teenage daughter's friend. And at the end of the movie, he gets his head blown off. Yeah, I mean, it's just so, you leave the theater and you just feel so enriched by having been there. I mean, it's just so dark and it's so dreadful, and you watch it and you say, what's the point? And why did everybody love this? Why did they give this thing awards? I mean, yuck! Now, interesting point. Christians ought to generally applaud art that demonstrates the darkness of life without Jesus. And we do the exact opposite. Do you know it? We applaud movies and we say, oh, that was so wholesome. And it all worked out at the end and everybody loved each other and it was so redemptive, and yet there's no mention of Jesus, which means that it's nothing but escapism, and actually it's a lie. It's a lie. Christians generally ought to applaud works of art that demonstrate the emptiness of life without Jesus. The problem with this movie, though, and so many others of its ilk, is it has the underlying and not subtle at all message to say that life comes through transgression. Salvation comes by breaking the rule. That's what you do. Tell your boss he's a jerk. Quit your job. Abandon your marriage. Have an affair. Do your own thing. Be God. Make your own choices. Break society's taboos. Violate all the mores. And let me tell you something. Isn't that the message our world is parading in its art, in its movies, in its music endlessly? Salvation comes by what? Transgression. Break the rules. Have it your way. And if anything, Romans chapter 5 and the rest of the Bible ought to tell us that's the way to what? death. Maybe it's good at the end of the movie that this guy ends up with a bullet in his head. Because that's the truth. That if you're in Adam, life stinks and then you die. Jesus Christ, the nature of his work is completely different. Adam claimed what was not his. Authority, autonomy, sovereignty. Jesus Christ took what was his. And he laid it aside, didn't he? Jesus Christ says salvation comes by the way of what? Obedience, not transgression. Obedience, submission. And so he gets on a donkey and he rides into Jerusalem to die. And when he kneels in the garden, he says, Father, must I? And the Father says, yes. And Jesus says, not my will, but thine. Thy will be done. He submits to his Father at every point. So you need to see that Adam's choice and Jesus' choice are completely separate. And they're separate as to their nature. They're separate as to their effect. Adam's choice leads to our condemnation. Jesus' choice leads to our justification. And they're separate as to their power. How powerful is the effect of Adam's role as family leader? How powerful was his choice? How much has it affected your life and my life and all of mankind? Could scarcely be imagined that anything could be more powerful than the effects of sin. But there's just something better. It's called what? Grace. What does verse 20 say? Where sin increased, then grace abounds all the more. As powerful as sin is to ruin a life, grace is more powerful to rescue it. It says that right in verse 15. The free gift is not like the transgression. For if by the transgression of Adam many died, much more did the grace of God and the gift by the grace of the one man, Jesus, abound to the many. Grace always trumps sin. Grace always wins. Grace can change any heart and any life, anytime. So here's the point. Adam and Jesus, they are so different, but in this one point, they are the same. And here's the primary point of the whole passage. Their one act determined the destiny of their entire family. Adam's one act of disobedience made us legally what? Legally sinners. Jesus' one act of obedience makes us legally what? Makes us legally righteous. Wait, I don't like that. I don't like Adam being able to choose for me. I don't like having to be held responsible for Adam's transgression. Don't you see it? This is the beauty of God's plan. How many now are raising their fists saying, I don't want to be held, accounted justice for just for Jesus' obedience. Why should Jesus' life count for me? Well, that's the very thing we need, isn't it? That just as Adam's choice counted for us, so Jesus' choice counts for us. His obedience as our family representative, as our family warrior, as our family head, counts for all of us. What he chooses, we chose. That's just the way it works in God's economy, and God's people ought to say hallelujah. Because that means scum like us have a chance. Just to kind of be frank. The Bible says Jesus is our representative. He took the penalty that we deserve for failing the test. The test Adam failed meant that all men are captured in sin and all men die. Jesus took the death that we deserve. He's our representative in paying our penalty, and he is our representative in fulfilling our probation. Do you understand when we say to people, if you stand before God and he says, why should I let you into heaven? It's not enough to say, well, Jesus died for me. Because in dying for you, Jesus takes your penalty, but if he only restores you to the place of Adam, you are still liable to sin and lose it all. Jesus didn't just take your penalty away, he fulfilled your probation. So that when you are made righteous through the transfer of the obedience of Christ to you, you can never lose it. The probation is over. You are locked in as being righteous before God for all eternity. It's done, it's sealed, it's wrapped up, it's forever. That's what Jesus did for us. As our mighty man, as our warrior, as the defeater of our Goliath in sin and death as our representative. He obeyed God at every point of his life. And by doing that, he has provided for us a perfect obedience. Does it not say that exactly in the 19th verse? As through the one man, Adam's disobedience, many were made sinners, even so through the obedience of Jesus, the many will be made what? Righteous. So that the living God, holy, holy and just, looks at us and he sees people who, as far as he's concerned, fed the 5,000. As far as he's concerned, healed the lepers. As far as he's concerned, did every act of obedience, kindness, and goodness that Jesus did. It's all given to us. And he loves us passionately. So how do you get in that family? You want to be in the family of Adam, the family where the head of the family has screwed up his whole family, leading to sin and death? Or do you want a new, whole new line, a whole new family of which Jesus is the head? And his obedience has secured for his family forever life and joy and peace and eternity. Which family do you want to be in? How many people are still saying, I'm choosing Adam? I want to tell you, most people are. I'm choosing Adams because in Adam's family, I'll do whatever I blank well please. And that's what's my highest value. A friend of mine emailed me this week. I told you about his little brother a couple weeks ago. He's had a cocaine addiction. Nobody in the family knew. For 10 years, he's had a cocaine addiction. And he said, you know what comes with a cocaine addiction? Usually theft and embezzlement and other things to support that habit. He's not only been thrown out by his wife, but last week he got arrested. He'd probably go to jail. And he said, I got the call. My brother's arrested. He's in jail. He said, I thank God my parents were out of town. Didn't have to experience this. He said, I drove down and God was there, you know, because the bail bondsman was somebody I taught Sunday school to 24 years ago when he was a fifth grader. And he helped me out and they were able to bail my brother out of jail. My brother was so ashamed. He wouldn't even look at me. There we sat in this dingy, you know, bail bondsman's office. They're making jokes and the bars on the windows and my brother is filled with self-loathing and shame. He said, so convinced that he could save himself, he could work his way out of this dilemma. He said, I did not think the night would end with my brother still alive. I was convinced he would take his own life. 31 years old. I mean, good looking like a model. I mean, gregarious and all kinds of personal gifts, and now his life lay in utter ruin. He said, as we rode back to our part of town, my brother said, is God in this? Did God cause me to get arrested? My friend thought, I don't want to crush this guy's fragile spirit. He dropped him off that night and wasn't sure he'd ever see his brother again. The next day, his brother called. He said, 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke up, Mike. And he said, I got on my knees and I talked to Jesus for the first time. He said, and I realized that I had absolutely nothing to offer God. I saw the utter bankruptcy of my life. And I talked to Jesus and I experienced his love. My friend said, this kind of sounds to me like maybe you joined his family last night. And he said, you know, I think I did. They started meeting last week to study the book of Mark together. Older brother's going to get to disciple his little brother in Jesus. How do you join this new family of Jesus? You have to get to the point where you understand that you have absolutely nothing to offer God. Because as long as you hold out one shred of hope that you've got what it takes, you're still in Adam's family. The family of Jesus. What's the fruit for those who have a family leader like Jesus? They are no longer in bondage to sin. They are no longer in bondage to death. My friend said of his little brother, he said, He doesn't want to die anymore. Now he wants to live. But he's ready to die. Because when you come to be in the family of Jesus, sin no longer holds you in bondage. You can't. You got a new family head. He resisted Satan. He stood the test in your place. And he gives you a new heart. He changes you. There are people in this room right now held in the addiction of pornography on the internet. There are people in this room right now who have long held bitternesses and fears that keep you bound up. And I want to tell you, your new family leader, the father of your family, Jesus, is coming in. He's sending his spirit. He's going to bore into your heart. And he's not going to let those sins hold you bondage. Because grace trumps sin. And he will have his children set free. Sin does not hold you in bondage, and neither are you under the reign and tyranny of death. J. Gresham Machen, the founder of the seminary I graduated from at age 54 in Bismarck, North Dakota, is about to succumb to pneumonia. And in his last recorded words, he says, laying on his deathbed, how I thank my God for the obedience of Jesus Christ. Some people say, oh, I just can't stand when we talk about doctrine. Let me tell you, when you're dipping your toes in the icy water of death that separates us from this life and the life to come, then you want to have solid doctrine to set your feet on. And the solid doctrine is this, is that Jesus Christ is our surety, who stands before the throne of grace and represents us before the Father. He stands there as our older brother. That's utter assurance. That allows us to stare death in the eye and be unafraid. And that's precious. A guy in our church has found himself in the throes of financial difficulty. He is so deep in debt that it wouldn't matter how hard he worked, he couldn't get out of it. You know what I'm talking about? No manner of self-effort will extricate him from where he is. And so as people gathered around to say, what can we do? We got the exciting news this week that his brother is going to come here from out of state. And his brother is going to come and work with him and for him until he is set free. Wouldn't you die for a brother like that? You don't have to. You have one. His name is Jesus. And he came and died for you so that he could stand before God as your surety, cover all of your debts, and provide a perfect obedience. You've got a warrior. You've got a champion. You've got a family head. Fix your eyes on him all the way to the end of the race. Amen. Take your worship order, will you?